Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin, filling in for David Ford. Today, we kick off the hour with some insight into an incredibly versatile instrument, the saxophone. Several members of the acclaimed Red Clay Saxophone Quartet stopped by WFDD to talk to David Ford about the history of the instrument and its place in a modern-day quartet. Then today's show becomes no-nonsense, literally. We'll chat with the comedic duo and no-nonsense comedy co-founders Pat McLeod and Eric Trundy about stand-up, improv, and their frequent Greensboro appearances. After the laughs, it's time for some ear candy with The Sweets. Triad Arts Weekend technical producer Eddie Garcia catches up with a new local band that often collaborates from afar. And finally, it's a tribute and celebration of the literary and visual artist A.R. Ammons. All of this is coming up after the news. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. Single Threads Unbraided, a celebration of the work of A.R. Ammons, was the title Wake Forest University gave for their symposium celebration of one of the school's most famous and talented alumni. Later this hour, we'll speak with Kenneth McLean to help us understand the creativity of this artist. But first, Music for a Great Space has been bringing world-class classical chamber music, including piano, jazz, organ, vocal, and instrumental ensembles, to the great spaces of Greensboro for 22 years. And last year, that list of genres extended to the world of the saxophone quartet. The saxophone was invented by Belgian Adolf Sax in the mid-1800s. Sax was a musical instrument designer and musician who played the flute and clarinet. Since his saxophone creation, the soprano, alto, tenor, and baritone saxophones have played huge roles in jazz halls, wind ensembles, chamber music, and military bands. Over the last several decades, the sax has become an instrument of choice for dozens of outstanding contemporary composers as well, many of whom have selected North Carolina's Red Clay Saxophone Quartet to premiere their works. One half of the Red Clay Saxophone Quartet recently stopped by to talk shop. Duke University and Music Academy in Greensboro, saxophone instructor and soloist Susan Fancher plays soprano saxophone in the group, and she was joined by associate professor of composition and electronic music at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, baritone saxophonist Mark Ingebretson.
When played well, the saxophone's got the most gorgeous vocal sound. What drew you to the instrument, Mark?
I think my story is a little bit pedestrian. I mean, I had been playing the piano, and I didn't like that. And then I tried percussion, and this is like in fourth grade, and I wasn't very good at that. And sort of in desperation, I looked around the house to see what was there. And there were a couple of saxophones that were my father's. And I said, well, you know, I'll just play one of those.
Perfect.
And it was kind of a love at first sight sort of thing, whereas I'd struggled with some of those other instruments, I was immediately pretty good at the saxophone. I don't know why.
I think it's a good story for parents out there and grandparents looking to maybe introduce music to their children, and that a lot of times it is that fit. You can thrash around and then throw your hands up and say, I guess I'm not musical, but where in fact, if you've been introduced to a few more instruments, you never know.
You might have found your passion.
Yeah, you might have found it. How about you, Susan?
Well, my story is not that different from Mark's, actually. Yeah. I was taking piano lessons, of course. They were required in my house. Uh-huh. Had to take piano lessons, so I started piano when I was 7. And then in fourth grade, they came around with the band instruments started talking about the band program. And I went home and I said to my mom, oh, I definitely want to be in band. I want to be in band. And my parents were not very happy about this because they knew that meant they were going to have to buy an instrument. Well, they asked around the family, and I had two choices. My uncle had a trombone lying around in a closet, and my aunt had a saxophone lying around in a closet. Well, I had no idea what a saxophone was, but it sounded cool. So I said, oh, definitely want to play the saxophone. Just got to play the saxophone. And then when they brought it and I saw how shiny it was with those pearl buttons and everything, it was kind of love at first sight, and I just took off. I loved it.
Yeah. Just to look at one of those instruments, they are beautiful.
They are.
In so many varieties. And I want to talk about some of them because I think for a lot of listeners, they immediately, first off, think sax, jazz, you know, and there's a whole world of saxophone performance. But I guess we got to go back at the beginning, and this guy, Adolf Sax. Who was he? When did he live? And what do you know about this guy?
Adolf Sax came from a famous family of instrument makers, and his dad was an instrument maker, and he was an instrument maker himself. And I think he's probably even, well, he's most famous, I suppose, for the saxophone now, but at his time, he was very famous for improvements he made to the bass clarinet.
That's right. I forgot that.
Yeah.
That's why I love this show. I get to learn something again. But what was he, what niche was he trying to fill with the saxophone? Orchestrally or band-wise or what application?
Yeah, yeah. He was trying to fill gaps in the orchestra, sort of between the brass and the strings. And he's also trying to provide an instrument that could be played in the military bands outside.
And we're talking turn of the last century, like late 1800s?
Around 1840 is when he actually invented the instrument. And his idea was, first and foremost, to have a classical music instrument. That's what he was looking for. And the instrument became very popular in the brass bands and the military bands in France in particular.
What was the first one? Because we know there's a whole family of them we'll get into. Was it an alto sax first? What did
goodness. I think at least that's out of my depth. I mean, he made a whole bunch of them in all kinds of what for us would be exotic keys. You know, now the saxophones are all keyed in B flat or E flat. But I mean, there were C instruments, you know, in F and all kinds of crazy things. But today, you know, there are four main instruments of the saxophone family, which correspond roughly to the ranges of the human voice: soprano, alto, tenor, and baritone.
And then at the extreme ranges, we've got a couple others.
Yes, there's a sopranino, which is even smaller than the soprano. It is exactly an octave higher or smaller, depending on how you want to say it. It's the same from the alto saxophone. And there is, in fact, even a smaller saxophone that's called a soprillo. And I heard it played.
It's like a glorified kazoo.
A shawm.
There's an English musician by the name of Nigel Wood, I believe his name is, who played the soprillo at the World Saxophone Congress in Thailand. When I'm pretty sure that's when it was that Nigel Wood was playing the soprillo, and it's really only barely a foot long.
It's like an E-flat clarinet, a little piccolo clarinet.
Must be in B-flat, right?
And it's in B-flat, so it's even smaller than the E-flat
clarinet.
And then you get the bass saxophone, which is fairly common. I mean, there are, you know, the local universities probably own one bass saxophone. It comes up in the wind ensemble repertoire from time to time, and saxophone ensembles, of course, want to have a bass saxophone. Yeah. But then there's also a contrabass saxophone, which there are not very many of those.
How many of those are in the world? Any idea? Like a dozen?
It's something like 30. Yeah.
30. Yeah. I've seen pictures of them before.
They're huge.
Yeah, they're like
huge.
Bigger than I am.
They're bigger than
you could lose a small child inside.
You had to get that one in there. All right. So we've got the sax family. And it's similar evolution of the clarinet, too, because there was a C clarinet, an F clarinet, a D clarinet, but I could go on. And initially, the hope being to incorporate into the orchestral repertoire as well as bands.
Well, they didn't have jazz back then.
No jazz back then.
That was pre-jazz,
that was it.
Right?
It was a classical instrument.
Classical instrument in the beginning and very popular in the bands, and it still is. It's still one of the main sections in your wind ensemble.
Yeah.
But it didn't really take off as a regular member of the symphony orchestra. You get saxophones in the symphony orchestra with special parts and Mio, Creation du Monde, as you were talking about earlier,
Rachmaninoff,
and Bolero, of course, has a soprano and a tenor saxophone part. Yeah. So it's there, and of course, if you go to Pops concerts, you almost always see at least a couple of saxophones, if not an entire section.
Right. Performance-wise, let's make the distinction then, because again, I think in the ears of a lot of listeners, if you've never heard classical saxophone, especially as an ensemble, there's something about a group of instruments all in the same family, a blending of sounds that's just so beautiful for me, be it a recorder ensemble or certainly a string quartet and a saxophone quartet. Similarly, what's the difference in terms of your performance approach classically versus in a jazz setting?
Sure. I mean, I guess, you know, the main definition in my mind of classical music versus jazz really has to do with the improvisation. But let's put that aside for a moment and talk about style. Mm-hmm. There's certainly a little difference in sound. You know, a classical saxophone, while the old thinking was that you had this kind of really small, stuffy sound, and we don't really play like that. I mean, we play with the, you know, beautiful, rich, round, you know, full tone, but there's tends to be a little bit less edge to it, a little less bite. We use the vibrato in a more narrow range, whereas in jazz, you know, you might have a lot more variety and width to your vibrato, you know, whoa, whoa, you know, something like that, where in classical music, you're probably not going to do that kind of a sound.
You think of vibrato, say, on a string instrument or with a voice.
Right, the classical saxophone is going to be more like that. Yeah, yeah. It's going to be more like how you would hear a classical singer, or the violin's a great example, yeah.
Right.
Well, as much repertoire, I mean, you alluded to the three biggies in terms of the classical orchestral repertoire for sax, Bolero, Creation of the World, the Rachmaninoff, but maybe a few pieces there, but in the world of 21st century music now, or 20th century music, composers love this instrument and have for years and years. And Mark, why, from the composer's standpoint? Because in addition to being a great performer, you're a wonderful composer.
You know, one of the reasons why composers love the saxophone is that saxophonists are really interested in developing the repertoire for their instrument. And so saxophonists are, you know, very engaged in the idea of playing new music. So, you know, part of it is there's a sort of a symbiotic relationship there between composers and performers. Mm-hmm. At the same time, when you look at the history of a lot of popular music, jazz, rock in the 20th century, a lot of that music has been shaped by the saxophone and by its natural forms of expression. And I think, you know, composers, being a product of their time, are really interested in that instrument that has figured so prominently in the music that's around us every day.
To some extent, this is true for any instrument. I mean, there's a certain level of virtuosity that you need to be able to have to free you up and express and take on new works. But particularly the saxophone, one of those instruments, like flute, I would say, where you're pretty much expected to be able to play anything.
Yeah, I think you're really hitting on something here, because part of the attraction to composers is the really high level of technical skill that saxophonists are trained to have. I mean, we can play really fast and we can do a lot of really cool techniques, and composers, you know, they like to take advantage of that. It's really fun for them to be able to write some really hard music and have people dig in and take it on. And also the connection with popular music definitely is appealing to especially younger composers. One of the most fun projects I've ever worked on is collaborating with some of the young composers at universities and listening to the interesting ideas they come up with. And they're very often related to jazz or rock or pop and club styles of music now.
Duke University and Music Academy in Greensboro, saxophone instructor and soloist Susan Fancher plays soprano saxophone in the Red Clay Saxophone Quartet, and she was joined by Associate Professor of Composition and Electronic Music at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, baritone saxophonist Mark Ingebretson. The Red Clay Saxophone Quartet has performed at Music for a Great Space in Greensboro and festivals throughout the Southeast. Susan and Mark are joined in the group by alto saxophonist Robert Faub and tenor Steven Stusek. You'll find links to Red Clay's complete performance schedule on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. They're available for concerts, workshops, and masterclasses. I'm Bethany Chafin, in for David Ford today, and you're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. Coming up on the second half of the show, we get to know the local band, The Sweets, as they remind us just how cool a cassette tape can be. We'll also take a look at the life and work of poet and artist A.R. Ammons. In the meantime, though, we'll speak with comedians Pat McLeod and Eric Trundy. They're the co-creators of No Nonsense Comedy at the Idiot Box in Greensboro. No Nonsense is a stand-up comedy show featuring some of the best comedians in North Carolina. The showcase for local talent has stand-up performances every Friday at 8 p.m. and improv comedy Friday nights at 10. On Saturday nights at 8, there's improv comedy that's clean and fun for the whole family, and on Saturday nights at 10, it's, well, not so clean. And if you'd like to try your hand at a little stand-up, there's always open mic night at the Idiot Box, Thursdays at 8 p.m. You'll find links to the complete Idiot Box calendar at wfdd.org. Click on Triad Arts Weekend. A note for listeners, Eric Trundy and Pat McLeod are adult comedians, and some of their material may not be suitable for children.
It's a mad world.
Okay, yeah.
Milton Berle, yeah. Jonathan Winter. There's a confidence and a timing that I see in very few comics today when I hear those guys talk.
Yeah.
And expand it to women. Phyllis Diller, same thing.
Yeah.
In her prime.
Joan Rivers,
yeah. Exactly.
It's stage presence, and you either have it or you don't. And you can actually be funny without having stage presence, and you can even have stage presence without being funny.
That's true.
I've seen guys go up there with all the confidence in the world and just bomb, but they do it in such a way you're like, okay, at least he's alive up there.
You look at a Stephen Wright or an early Woody Allen. No presence at all. They're just hovering and twitching.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
Hilarious.
And brilliant. Yeah,
and
both
brilliant.
Those guys are brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's something you get more comfortable with, too. You know, like, I talk about a lot of depression.
No.
Yeah, I've gone through bouts of everything in my life. But,
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. It's okay. I'll take your sympathy. But I went to the shrink, and she told me I was depressed, and she gave me these pills for depression. What are they called? Veltrax. You know, herpes, depression, same stuff. And people tell me, you know, Eric, herpes joke's not funny. And I say, well, why does it burn when I laugh, you know? Every now and again, I do get stressed out. I get these cold sores on my lips, and I think it's unfair that people automatically assume that I have herpes because I have cold sores, because there's a difference between cold sores and herpes, and I know the difference because I have both. I wake up most times feeling like just a hack and a fraud.
Before you go on stage, the day after?
When I wake up, but then I get on stage and the crowd tells me I am. You know what I mean? And I still, some days, don't believe it. But I only do it because once out of every 25, 30 times I get up, I'm satisfied. So I'm chasing that rush constantly. You know, it's that high of they are happy and I'm happy most times, you know. But and I watch guys like that, the old time guys, and even some guys now today, and I just, it makes me want to jump off a building. You know what I mean? Like
they're good.
They're so much better than I'll ever be remotely close to.
First off, I'm the number one fan you guys ever want to have in a comedy club, because I will laugh at just about anything, because I respect what it takes to get in front of a room full of people and make them laugh.
Yeah, I always tell people there's nothing noble about people who get up on stage. Like, it looks like it. Like we're doing the world some service, but we all just want that attention, really, at the end of the day.
I mean, selfish, needy children.
Selfish, needy children. Look at me.
Why are you rewarding us for this?
It feels like I benefit more than the audience does. You know what I mean? Because I need that attention and love that I've never had in my life. You know what I mean?
So I want
it for a minute.
So, Pat, you've been doing stand-up comedy for a year. What's that evolution?
It's most people that do comedy, including myself, I think, they'll tell you, like, I've wanted to do it for, like, 20, 30 years. and that was just it. I wanted to for decades, and I just didn't. I don't want to go on stage. It's terrifying. And a friend of mine actually signed up for an improv class, and she's got, like, two kids and a full-time job, and she went and did this, and I was like, well, you know, forget you. I'm going to go do it now just to show you. I'm going to go. So I went to a Comedy Zone and did their open mic night, again, almost a year ago. And, like, as soon as I came off the stage, I was like, okay, I need to do this a lot and often. I need to – I can remember every moment of that 4.5 minutes I was on stage.
Give me a couple highlights from that, because I'd love to get, you know, have listeners get a chance to be inside the mind of the comic during the process of that. I mean, was it a shtick you'd worked out before? You'd rehearsed it? You knew what you were going to say? Or was it all improv?
I'm a writer first. When I had gone up for the first time, I had already written probably every eye blink is scripted.
And I hate that.
You're not. You can't
I can't do that.
Barely literate.
So I can't
write all you want.
Can't read or write, so I just go up and kind of talk up there.
Poor guy. More hugs for Eric. But anyway, Pat, it's all about you now. Some of your shtick comes from family life. I've got a 7-year-old at home. Well, how old are your kids?
One of them just turned 3, and the other one is 4.5. And they're girls, too.
Okay.
And it's hard to raise a girl in 2012. You know, just the other day, I was making some cookies in the kitchen.
Yeah,
just
chocolate
chip cookies for the girls.
Love them.
And my 4-year-old walks in. And I was like, "Hey, have a cookie." And she said, "No, I probably shouldn't eat these because I'll get fat and boys won't like me."
Oh my God.
At 4, and I had to actually tell her, "No, honey, there are a lot of good, smart, wonderful boys out there with a fat fetish," and and they'll actually, you know.
And they bought into it?
They have conventions every year, so you'll be fine.
Thank God for the fetishists out there.
Yeah. But the other thing about being 4 is she just, she doesn't think the way I want her to think. For example, the other day she left one of her puzzles in the yard, and I was mowing the lawn and I mowed over it. And to hear her tell it, I destroyed her puzzle. But I think I made it a better puzzle. Yeah. Get your tweezers, honey. We're doing this.
We could do this thing.
All right.
That's great.
But I mean, you're up on stage first time. Your heart must have been racing, for starters.
Right. One of the things that Jerry Seinfeld talks about is anytime you write, you literally, you don't know if it's the funniest thing ever or the worst thing ever until they tell you.
Mm.
And so the first time I went up, I didn't know any of it because I had never done it. So I have my 4 minutes, and I was afraid I would forget it too. So I'm terrified. And if you look at the video, my hand is shaking holding the microphone. I'm not sure if they noticed or if they could see, but I'm just like, sweat is just pouring out of like my backside mainly.
This is an image for you.
Yeah, it's just terrified. And then like the first line I said, which wasn't even that great a line, but it was, I've got a problem. I have too many real life friends and not enough Facebook friends. And people laughed. It was like that one moment. I was like, okay, well, let's try the next line. Let's try the next. And I didn't even get through the 4 minutes I had planned because they were laughing at, you know, the things.
They strung it out too long with laughter and applause.
Yeah.
Don't you hate that?
Yeah. It's
That's a good problem to have.
What's funny is I actually sometimes do get annoyed, like when they laugh too long. I was like, I've got stuff I'm trying to say here. Will you guys just shut up and let me say my thing?
This is great material. That's you guys ridiculous. Are robbing me of my chance.
For comics, it's all about the minutes. It's all about how many minutes do I get? Well, how many minutes do you have? Oh, I have about 15 strong minutes, maybe 20 if I stretch it. Well, you get 6 minutes. Is that? Yeah, that's what you get. And, you know, for most comics, that's 6 minutes a week maybe that they can get. Or, you know, there's two open mics in Greensboro. You may get 10, 15 minutes a week at the most. I drove to Fayetteville for a free show a few months ago because I got 20 minutes. I was like, I've never done 20. I've got to go do 20 minutes. Wow. So I drove and stayed at a friend's house. And again, to do this for free, just to get the minutes.
To go from 6 to 20 minutes, though, that's a... do the math. That's a huge leap.
I'm not sure that people who don't do it realize how long it takes to come up with those minutes. My goal for the first year was to have 5 minutes at the end of the year. Because you can talk for... I could talk forever. Any of us could. But be interesting for that amount of time is a completely different thing. You know, keep people laughing with you. It's really difficult. And when you find something funny, it's typically pretty short. It's a 30-second joke that works, and then you got to find a spot for it, and which is why I like, you know, Pat goes up and he's reading and memorizing, and I'm just kind of, I have an idea, and then I'm going to go and talk about that, and then I refine it. So I have jokes that I know every beat to. I'll tell them the same way every single time, but in finding the new stuff for me is. Torturous process. It's horrible. I go up there and nobody laughs. And I get one laugh every couple of minutes, and then I record that, and I go home and say, all right, well, now I got to build something around this 5-second giggle I got. You know what I mean?
So how is that, the fraternity of comics?
Oh, yeah.
Honestly, I always see comedians walk off stage, the second they're off stage, the frown sets in and they look like they're hard
as
nails.
Saddest group of people you've ever met.
Yeah.
Most depressing group of people to be around. You would think it'd be a laugh a minute. It's really not. There's a lot of sickness, mental and otherwise, and just rampant depression. It's fun.
We need help.
That's what comedy is. It's therapy for those of us who can't afford it or find a shrink who will see us 5 times a week for an hour at a whack, you know?
The comics we know, a lot of them actually bring their own baggage emotionally. And, for example, a good friend of ours, Ryan Higgins, he's a comic in
Greenville. He's one of my favorite people in the world. He's hilarious. He's going to be a guy you see on TV. Like, absolutely, it's going to happen. He's brilliantly funny. He's tortured. He's a mess. He's a broken person. He's going through some a cancer scare right now, and he's talking about it on stage. And
wait, hold on. It's not a cancer scare. A cancer scare is where you don't know if you have cancer. He's going through cancer.
Yes.
That's a different thing.
Yeah.
And that became his act, really.
Yeah, it's become a heavy part of his act, and it leads to some really great conversations with us because I went through some health stuff, and I had to make some phone calls that day. And everybody was really sad for me. And then I talked to two of my comedian friends, and they just tore me to shreds. And it made me feel better.
How about that?
Yeah.
It seems like someone told me once, you got to be able to laugh at anything, otherwise it's lost. You ever single anybody out, Pat? That doesn't seem like that's your
style.
Like
in the audience?
In the audience.
I really hate that, the whole idea of attacking the audience. No, I'll play with them some, but why would you want someone that paid to come in to feel bad?
And my thing on stage is, if I get a heckler, I will annihilate him. But the crowd is guaranteed to be full of people who are better than me. So I treat them as such, you know what I mean? The Idiot Box, it's a mainly improv club, and that's what we've stepped in and done some stand-up because we think there's funny enough people. But if anybody wants to see the improv over there, every Friday at 10, if you come to the No Nonsense show, you get a half-price ticket to stay for the improv, which is it's really funny. Those guys do a really good job. Anybody who's ever thought about doing it just should do it. It's not as scary being on stage as it is walking up to the stage. And once you get on stage, the worst part is over with. Now. You run it's your a lot mouth of fun. And I run my business, brother.
You run your mouth and I run my business, brother. No Nonsense Comedy co-founders Pat McLeod and Eric Trundy. You can see them in action on the first, second, and fourth Friday of every month at 8 p.m. at the Idiot Box in Greensboro. It features 5 to 6 different local comics hosted by Eric. No Nonsense is a stand-up comedy show featuring some of the best comedians in North Carolina. Their stand-up performances are every Friday night at 8, with improv comedy Fridays at 10. On Saturday nights at 8 p.m., there's improv comedy that's good, clean fun for the whole family. And on Saturday nights at 10 p.m., it's adult humor. If you'd like to try your hand at a little stand-up, there's always open mic night at the Idiot Box, Thursdays at 8 p.m. You'll find links to more laughs at WFDD.org.
You run your mouth and I run my business, brother.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin. We're going to take a short break right now, and when we come back, Eddie Garcia talks to Winston-Salem-based garage pop band The Sweets. Winston-Salem-based garage pop band The Sweets may have only started writing and recording music in December of 2012, but that hasn't stopped them from building quite a discography. Brothers Zach and Justin Romeo set out to record and release one EP a month since the band's inception, and so far they're keeping up the pace and then some. In this brief time, they've also hooked up with not one, but two independent record labels. Bleeding Gold Records out of San Diego will be releasing their music here in the States, and across the pond in Liverpool, their tunes will be distributed by Edel's Recordings. While the brothers do attend colleges hundreds of miles apart, Asheville and New York City to be exact, they're here in Winston-Salem this summer and will be playing some live shows before they return to their studies. Check WFDD.org for dates. The Sweets were interviewed by Triad Arts Weekend's technical producer, Eddie Garcia.
All right, and you guys are brothers.
Yeah.
So is this the kind of thing where have you been playing music together all your life, or is this something that just happened later?
Well, Justin started playing music before I did. He's always been definitely the better guitar player, I'd say, and he's in music school now, and we both fell in love with the Strokes at the same time, essentially, and then that's when we first started. I decided I really wanted to play music when I heard, "Is This It?" And then we both started covering those songs together.
Yeah. I would say that like I got serious about my love of music around the time I found "Is This It?"
So when did, I guess, The Sweets then officially start?
So The Sweets just started in December.
December of 2012. Yeah.
And then
just started playing in the garage, being loud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're really loud. Our first songs are just so much noise, it's absurd, yeah.
Really loud, how you were attacking the songs, or is that, do you have giant amplifiers?
Well, at that point, we were really being influenced a lot by artists like Ty Siegel and the OCs, so our idea of what we should do is just be as loud as possible. It wasn't really a complicated set of instruments or anything. It was just really, we just, we distorted everything and we were screaming all the lyrics.
At the time we had a drum set, which we don't have anymore, but we had a drum set and we would play with Zach on guitar and I would be drumming. We didn't have a microphone either, so Zach would just be like screaming as we played our instruments.
Yeah, and we were hoping it would pick it up. Those were our demos.
Okay, you've since acquired microphones, I take it.
Yeah.
You have a lot of recordings available for just starting in December of 2012. Tell me about that process, how you went from having a month of free time to start bashing out some songs and then kind of immediately start putting the songs, you know, down.
Well, we went back to school. I actually went back before Zach did. And then he ended up recording a couple more songs, which became our second EP, Jan. And then, I don't know, we were just getting so productive that we were just like, hell, why not?
We sent some songs out to some websites and they featured them. And that was really exciting for us. And we were like, maybe we should keep doing this.
What websites featured your music?
There were like a number of small blogs. Chunky Glasses.
Yeah, it's this blog out of DC. Really nice guy, Kevin.
Yeah, he put our music out. He wanted to do like a feature kind of monthly from us. So we decided that we should keep playing music. And then we started using this site called Dropbox to share our music project files. And then we just take turns adding to the file from where we were in New York and Asheville separately. And the songs would just kind of build that way on the just kind of floating around space online. Yeah. And then when we figured it was done, we would just release it.
So you've been writing these songs while you're in two different places, is what you're saying then.
Yeah, one of us would guess start like a demo of something. I would say usually Zach would have like the rough sketch of a demo. He would send it to me, I would change some things, add some things, send it back to him. It was just a very back and forth process online. They were both recorded in dorm rooms, or I guess all of our tracks.
Yeah, we had a lot of trouble working around our roommates' schedules and stuff like that.
Yeah. We've since started recording on a four-track tape recorder that we got off Craigslist.
Like a Tascam Portastudio type of stuff?
Yeah.
Or like a real... Oh, okay. Yeah. Great. And Justin, you're in Asheville, right?
I am, yeah.
So, Zach, you're in New York. You're attending NYU?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you're in Asheville?
UNC Asheville.
UNC Asheville. So, those are two clearly vibrant music scenes as well. Is that frustrating to kind of be around all that music and not be able to, you know, go out and play shows? Or is it kind of inspiring, give you something to...
It's definitely frustrating. All this past semester at school, we were just talking about constantly how much we wanted to play these songs live. It's definitely let us grow a lot more as playing live. We just understand the songs better. At the same time, it's kind of nice because it allows us to purely focus on production. Then when we were together, it allowed us to spend all that time essentially trying to play shows. So it's a nice kind of organized separation of the two.
So now you're back in Winston-Salem this summer, both back from school. And so I guess you're getting the chance to play some shows together.
So basically, Zach, the second he got back from New York, we started practicing immediately because we had a show 3 days later.
3 days later, yeah. We had never played these songs live, so that was a little...
But in the meantime, though, I was working with our bandmates that play live with us. We have our friends Danner Washburn on drums and Justin Morris on bass and backing vocals. And they were both friends of ours in high school, and Justin's my roommate at Asheville. So I was rehearsing with them in the beginning stages, and then so it was easier for Zach to just hop on in and get ready to play live.
Yeah, it's definitely proven a lot easier with four people. I was in a two-person band before The Sweets called Boy Party, and it's so hard to create the energy and the sound with two people, that is, with four.
So it's going to be a little sad when you have to go back.
It will be, yeah.
I'm not trying to bring you guys down. Sorry. But, you know, there's breaks, right? Maybe, hopefully, you'll be able to come back.
Yeah, before. Hopefully.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about the sound of your music and the sound of the production of the records. One thing is the vocals and how the vocals are treated might be somewhat unique to some of our listeners. They're not clear in your face. They're not the focal point, but they provide a great through line through the song. They're treated in a way Cocteau Twins or My Bloody Valentine treated vocals as another instrument in the blend, not just as a, you know, distinct listen to me part. The thing I'm wondering about, though, with the lyrics not having the clarity, what is your feeling about that? You're saying specific things, but it's kind of mysterious. I am assuming that's intentional.
We've definitely always been in the arena of thinking where vocals, I think, are more of an instrument than anything else, and we like for it to play as a melodic through line.
So it's like Zach, for instance, would send me like a melody to add mine on. I mean, the way we do it is we both sing the same melody in unison, and then we'll add harmonies on top of that. Yeah, it's very much to kind of like mesh the voices together. We very much would rather the, like the mood of the song get across through the melody than like, I don't know, having to listen to what exactly we're saying.
It creates a really nice feel. It's interesting to listen to, I'm not going to say your early stuff because you really you haven't been playing together all that long, but you can already see that an evolution from the, you know, January EPs to the most recent items, and it's a little more loud and, you know, kind of bashing some of the earlier stuff, but now it's almost going in this chill wave-ish kind of feel, you know, not to categorize you, but since I have the microphone here, I have to categorize you. Even though as a musician, I don't like that.
No,
but,
sure.
You know, I feel that a little bit of that, whether it's an influence or not, I don't know, kind of washed out, neon Indian type stuff a little bit.
We haven't really tried to stick to a genre per se with any of our releases. Most of our releases have like a psychedelic song and then a maybe a garage rock song. Yeah, so it's
just pop.
So it's, yeah, it's interesting. There hasn't really been much of a direction as far as genre goes. I think it's just more of,
we have this plan to release at least one EP or something every month. I mean, if we're going to be doing all these releases, why not change up whatever we're doing or experiment a little bit? Like we record and release everything for free, or at least everything that we released online so far, except for our cassette. So I don't know, I feel like it just gives us a lot of room.
Well, that's refreshing to hear. I mean, why box yourself in? You know, you're doing this because you love doing it. So you're kind of exploring things as they develop, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you've also have some label interest, and not just in the States, but also in the UK. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, we originally got on Bleeding Gold Records kind of from the start, once we sent our second EP over to Roger, who's the label manager at Bleeding Gold Records. They're based in San Diego. We had some friends who were also on the label in North Carolina. The band Petey out of Raleigh and the band Alligator Indian out of Asheville.
Petey's the band that we split our recent cassette with,
right,
on Bleeding Gold.
So we had known about the label prior to us making music. It kind of put us in this pool of label friends that Bleeding Gold has, and one of them was Eatles Recordings over in London.
In Liverpool.
Not London, Liverpool.
Liverpool.
Yeah, sorry.
We're the Beatles.
Right. So we're working on a split CD that will come out on Eatles.
So I think I heard you say you did a split cassette with someone. Like a cassette? Like you play in a boombox?
Yeah, boombox, or some cars have it. I know my car has it. But yeah, split cassette with our friends Petey. They're great. They're out of Raleigh, North Carolina.
So why do you think cassette? Why cassette as an option for a physical release?
Well, I think the great thing about most physical releases, period, at this point, is that most of them will come with a free download code. So you'll be able to get the music regardless. But I know as a music collector and fan myself, it's a very kind of nerdy pleasure to collect physical, tangible evidence of your music interests.
We're both, you know, big record collectors and stuff like that. So
I think anything is just fun to have. Plus, cassettes are so cheap to make these days that it's just a go-to option for smaller bands. It's a good way to give something out at shows or sell something at shows.
That was our biggest issue when we played our shows in late May and early June. is we didn't have anything, like any sort of merch at the time. So we'd have people come up to us like, hey, could I get a CD? Or hey, could I get something? Now, thankfully, we have something.
So since we're talking about the physical releases, I would like to talk about your album art. I was going through your band campsite and seeing all the EP covers, and they, most of them, maybe with one or two exceptions, share a common trait. What would you say that common trait is?
Old pictures of naked women, I would say.
Yes.
So why is that your choice for covers?
Back when the Sweets were just beginning, we were trying to think of something that would be like eye-catching, and one of us just had the idea of like old naked pictures. And the way we saw, we were just releasing everything online for free as it was, so it's not like we were making money off of their image.
Okay. It's interesting, looking at Bleeding Gold Records' site too, well, they're not necessarily using those same types of pictures. They're using a lot of old photos too, like when you first go to their homepage. What do you think the allure of these older faded photographs is?
I feel like it's the same sort of scenario with people buying records now. There's always an interest in the retrospective, I feel like, with music, just because there's some sort of idea that once a song becomes old enough or broken down enough, not really up to today's technical standards, there's something cool about it. There's something unique about the fact that they had so little but still made a song. And so I think there's an attractive appeal with us for pictures in that way too, I guess.
All the pictures that are on Bleeding Gold website, those are all our pictures actually that we took. We've decided that like for all official releases that we have with a label, we're actually going to use pictures that we took.
Yeah, we have to for copyright reasons.
Yeah, so...
The song Sadie has this really slow tempo 1950s kind of romantic ballad type of thing that in kind of a possibly perverse way can almost accompany one of these pictures. I mean, do you go that far back sometimes with influences?
The way I've been describing Sadie has been prom rock. I think what happened...
We picture like an 80s prom.
Yeah.
I know, I'm not going to say like a John Hughes movie or anything, but like...
But essentially, I was thinking the movie The Virgin Suicides. That's like the image that kept coming into my mind during that song.
I mean, which isn't John Hughes, but yeah, Virgin Suicides, right. Sort of.
I think that song didn't really have that feel until we put in the... there's an echo drum loop for the verses of the song, and that was a total accident. Justin dropped in the drums on a track in our song file that had an echo effect over it, and when we hit play to see what it sounded like, we were surprised at first and almost took off the echo, but then we realized it was perfect. It was like, it just brought us back to this weird prom kind of time.
But at the same time, like with the guitars, we were trying to do like a Led Zeppelin sort of thing. We layered like three different guitar tracks all harmonizing with each other. We had a whole mixture of influences, I guess, for that song.
Zach and Justin Romeo of the Winston-Salem-based band, The Sweets. They were interviewed by Triad Arts Weekend's technical producer, Eddie Garcia. You can catch them playing their hazy guitar jams in Winston-Salem at Cranky's Coffee on August 2nd. And you can check WFDD.org for more dates. Their music is available for streaming and download online, and you can get yourself a copy of their split cassette, Just the Dudes, as well. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. We'll be back after a short break. Single Threads Unbraided, a celebration of the work of A.R. Ammons, was the title Wake Forest University gave for their symposium celebration of one of the school's most famous and talented alumni. The symposium on the Wake campus examined Ammons' poetry, letters, and visual art. NC poet and biographer Emily Herring Wilson donated 20 Ammons watercolors to Wake's permanent collection. Several world-class speakers participated in the symposium, including our guest today, Cornell University's W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Literature, Kenneth McLean. Ken was one of Archie's closest friends, and he shared the legacy of the man, the poet, and the artist. He spoke with David Ford by phone from his office in Ithaca, New York.
Both of my parents died of Alzheimer's. And there's a line in Arch, an early poem, where he says, "What destruction am I blessed by?" And that line is very real to me, not only in terms of my parents, because in some sense, almost everything that I think Ammons talks about, and I think everything that we really need to think about, is that, you know, like Blake, everything is the marriage of heaven and hell, right? I mean, I think that everything, interestingly enough, is complicated. It's sort of magnificent and wondrous if we pay true fidelity to it, right? Mm. And I think one of the reasons I've always respected Ammons is it's never simple for him. And yet, one of the things that so moves me is that this is a poet, one of the great sort of philosophical poets we have in this time, but also a great poet of human feeling and the heart. Some of those lyrics, poems like Silver, Nellie Myers, are poems that just testifies to what it means when one has that sort of infinite connection and infinite affinity to other living things, and what that means. When I first met Professor Ammons, I did it at the behest of a friend of mine. I didn't know anything about poetry, in all honesty. I was truly the intellectually unwashed. And I had no need or interest in soap. I just wanted to be. I was very happy, interestingly enough, at that moment at least, right, to be self-involved.
And we're talking the early college years? How old
were you? Yeah, I'm talking about 1969, 70. I was a freshman. And I came to Cornell. And, I mean, I had gone to a good school. It wasn't that I hadn't read things. But I just really was, you know, I'd gone from Harlem, right, to Ithaca by desire. Right, I came there because I felt that Cornell really was dealing responsibly with race, meaning it realized how complicated race was, and other schools weren't doing that. And Cornell at that time also was taking inner-city kids, not kids only from prep school, and that to me seemed to be really important. So when I came to Cornell, you know, this is also 69, so we've had the death of Dr. King. I mean, all this stuff is in my head. And Freedom Riders, interestingly enough, stayed with my family, as did Dr. King, for a week. And so I had all this stuff, and I really didn't know anything about Southerners. You know, I was a Northerner to the hilt. And that was a problem. I mean, it was a problem for me. So I remember I went to visit Professor Ammons, and I gave him some poems, or what I thought were poems. They were really drivel. They were terrible. But I didn't know that. You couldn't tell me that then. I didn't have a clue what I was doing. But anyway, I gave them to him. And he said, come back in a week's time, in that sort of lovely southern voice that he had. And I've got to admit, as soon as he spoke to me, I just said, there's nothing this man can tell me. And I didn't go back, which is something I'm actually saddens me even to this moment. I'm really embarrassed by that. But I actually believe in being truthful. So anyway, I decided to take creative writing next term. And lo and behold, who is the teacher but A.R. Ammons? There's no way that he didn't remember this. And he never mentioned it. And that's one of the things I really love about him. I mean, he had the forbearance, and he also understood, I think, as someone who was also, right, in some sense, the consummate outsider, what it meant, that often, in some sense, you were an errant. Almost, I felt like I was an errant. I was sort of an errant son trying to figure out, in some sense, to whose family I belonged. And I think that he understood that. I think he really loved those people who were wrestling.
Hmm. Right?
And it's interesting because after that, of course, we became the best friends, and I can't think of anyone I more value and more miss in many ways. But I have to tell you one other vignette. I went to see him that term when I was taking his course, and he was sitting there. All of a sudden, the phone rang, and we were talking about a poem of mine. And I'm watching Professor Ammons, and he's looking incredibly worried. I mean, the phone call was probably 30 seconds, and though I may have been of the intellectually unwashed, but I actually was well schooled by my mother in terms of manners. And when I saw this, I thought something really horrific had happened. You know, I figured that someone might have died, or that, you know, his house may have been on fire. I didn't know what. But he looked so concerned. I quickly stood up and I motioned, you know, that I was going to leave because I wanted him to have his privacy. And all of a sudden, Professor Ammons put his hand over the receiver. And he said, "Oh, no, 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 no. It was just a student. And she was asking if she had left her umbrella in my office." And I realized then that I was dealing with someone who had a level of empathy and sensitivity that I had never seen before. And in fact, that was true. And you can see that in those poems. I mean, it was almost as if he physically could not handle the demands of two flesh and blood creatures calling upon him at the same time.
Cornell University's W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Literature, Kenneth McLean. He spoke with David Ford by phone from his office in Ithaca, New York. Ken was one of several speakers at Wake Forest University's A.R. Ammons Symposium. That's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our intern is Kathleen Coker, and I'm Bethany Chafin, and for David Ford, who's on vacation this week. You'll find podcasts on our website at wfdd.org. Click on Triad Arts Weekend. While there, you can check out photos, complete interviews, and links to more information about all of our guests. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Please send us your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.